dual-sided coin. You start going near your wounds, you're actually getting kind of close to your gifts. Well, it's similar with shadow work. Like, you start going toward unsavory things, you also are starting to move toward golden things.
Hey everyone, Kyle here from the Voices Podcast. Thanks for clicking play on this week's episode. So today, Gary got to sit down with Kent Dobson, who just came out with a new book with an incredible title, Bitten by a Camel. And the story of the title is actually really, really entertaining. So on this episode, they get to talk about what it's like to be a pastor going through a faith transition, the Jewish context of the Bible, and hymns. So there's something for everyone here. So make sure you subscribe on iTunes to get notifications for future episodes or add us to your favorite podcast app. And if you want any more information on Kent's work or where you can buy his newest book, go to patreon.com/voicespodcast for all the info there. So with that, here is Gary's conversation with Kent Dobson. We're stoked to have you on the show, man. So thanks. For our audience, Kent has just released a book called Bitten by a Camel, which is an amazing read, recommended to you. I read it in two sittings because it just was such a fascinating story of your pilgrimage and your journey, and I found myself relating to it. So I first just say thanks, man, for doing what you do, for writing this and speaking to, I think, a lot of people what they're feeling.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah, man. So today we're going to talk some about his book, and we're going to get into some other stuff as well. So I want to pull out a couple lines that I think can help us kind of frame your book and the story behind it. So you talk about the couple phrases that stick out are you talk about how you went through a wild spiritual undoing. I love that. And that your faith set, belief set was no longer working. And then you get bit by a camel is all like those three things kind of are all wrapped together. So maybe just tell us the story of the title of the book and what happened.
Yeah, I mean, the title of the book is a kind of a symbol, and it's not a symbol at the same time. I on my kind of wild pilgrimage, which was existential, personal, and also a little bit academic, I moved to Israel to go to graduate school. So at the time, I was really interested in who was Jesus and what is this thing called the Bible and what are the origins of Christianity. And at the same time, I think a lot of my faith tenets from like evangelical Christianity were not working very well for me anymore. But I wasn't out and I wasn't in. I was maybe somewhere near the edge. And along the way, I also had, I don't know, certain very genuine hopes that God had some kind of plan that I could figure out, and that he was up there and he was listening, and at least I wanted him to be up there listening. And somewhere I got the idea that near the end of my first graduate degree there, that I would climb Mount Sinai and ask God what I should do with my life. And
As you do.
It sounds absurd to even say, and actually I was a little sheepish about it. It's not like I went around promoting this. It was a very private decision at the time. I'm going to sort of stuff my doubts into this little black bag behind me, and I'm going to genuinely, as I can, ask God what I should do with my life. And but the whole Sinai experience was kind of the opposite of what I imagined it to be. And it was confusing. It was freezing. And that's all in the first chapter of the book. And at the end of all this, not only did I not get any sort of direction for what's next, I was also bitten by a camel at the top of the mountains. And this became for me, it took a long time for it to settle in.
What year was this in?
I don't know. I'm really bad at like, it was 10 years ago, probably, okay. I'd say. Yeah, it was probably about 10 years ago. And like I said, it took a while for it to settle in, but it did become a kind of a symbol in my life that what I thought this thing called faith wasn't working. And in fact, I was being bitten in various places, and things were not working out. And it hurt, and I couldn't put the pieces back together again. And it was, I was either going to turn my attention toward these places that were not working, that I was bitten, so to speak, or I was going to, just be in denial. And I chose the very slowly chose, I guess I'm probably in denial about other things, but I chose to not be in denial about these places that were not working. And I was going to turn my attention to them. So that's kind of the opening story. And then what follows is a bunch of chapters about stuff that didn't work for me in terms of faith.
Yeah. So what were you doing at the time? Were you, you were studying at this time, or, cause I know you've also spent some time being a pastor, right? So.
Yeah, I was in graduate school. So I kind of, I worked for a big mega church doing the music. Then I went off to graduate school. And that's where a lot of this stuff was like, it was a catalyst for my own questions and also, kind of the academic path too, the path of study. And then eventually I moved back after living in Israel for 3 years and, worked for a private school for a while, teaching religion. And then I became a pastor. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you're in this pastor world and you're the one that has to get up on the stage to give the messages of inspiration and tell people what to believe. Right. I mean, that's kind of that's what you do if you're in that role. So for you, I mean, you're going through all this kind of like personal existential crisis, but you're kind of living in this world also. What was that like? I mean, how do you do that when you're going through so much internally?
Well, there was tension for sure, but I would say I was somewhat fortunate to work at this church in Grand Rapids, Mars Hill, because in this sense, they did respect authenticity, honesty. I didn't feel like shackled each week or something like that. No, I tried to get up and say the truth as best I could. And I was pushing against things. I was pushing against traditional ideas around faith and theology, and I felt some freedom to do so. Now, there was also this unstated, there were a few unstated lines like, well, you can't go too far. So, I guess I found myself to be in a pretty generous community, but, over time it was still a church. It was still a church built on, foundations of faith that I became less interested in either promoting or, defending. And once I started to lose my appetite for that, promoting or defending the sort of central, what is this thing standing on? That's when I started to realize, I have left the reservation. And I need to be honest about that. Yeah.
Was there a particular belief or ideology that, what was the first one, if you can remember, that kind of set you on the journey of, hold on a second?
Actually, that's a really hard question because as you probably know or can imagine, it's like a web. All these beliefs and ideas are interconnected and you start, tugging on the Bible and you're feeling the reverberations way over somewhere else. But I will say one thing that became not palatable to me, and this is actually in the book. And that is certain ideas of original sin that you are born somehow a problem to God, that the moment you're conceived, you are God can't accept you the way you are, that there's something wrong with you. That was unworkable for me, which means a lot of the other, particularly kind of atonement theology that's hanging around in evangelicalism, doesn't work because it's the solution to the problem. But what I started to say is that's not a problem, that one is not born a problem to God, that one is originally good or has divine DNA.
Where does that thought of original sin come from? Like what time period?
It's kind of the simple answer is it comes from Augustine in the fourth century. It's not in the Bible. It's absolutely not in the Bible. Now human beings are messy. I'm not trying to say that we're pure beings of light and you know, there's no such thing as evil or something like that. No, I mean, maybe it's more like we're original messy or something like that. But it comes from Augustine. Augustine and this other guy, if you really want to know the story, Pelagius, got into a debate in the fourth century and he lost. And he was of the idea that whatever we mean by sin was just poor human choices. But Augustine said, no, it's passed on like eye color, like traits. And the moment you're conceived, which by the way made sex kind of a problem inside the church, the moment of conception is that you are a problem to God and God has to punish you. That's the part that I became unworkable for me. Mm. That's basically like saying, hey, you're born into the world, but oh well, God's got to torture you for eternity just because you didn't think the right things and you are originally sinful. So that's one thing that started to, I started to say, I don't want to be in the business of promoting this subtly, or overtly. And,
okay. So, and then in that chapter, which I think that was my favorite chapter. Cause just the idea of original sin, I haven't read anything on it yet. So for me, I was like, oh my gosh, so helpful. But you say something in that chapter where you talk about how you had a talk with your music leader and you said, we don't want to be promoting that. So like 90% of the songs you were singing and hymns had to go.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my gosh. Yeah.
It's true. And actually the some of the most harmful theology are in the hymns. Because they're, many of them are the 19th, 20th century, hymns, Protestant hymns in particular, that are totally built upon you are a problem and Jesus's blood covers over all the problems. Well, that's atonement theology and that's a new development in Christianity. That's one of the things I probably don't get into too much in the book, but you don't find that kind of atonement theology, in most of church history. So, anyway, yeah. So most of the hymns, you're just, cause that's how they work. You're a problem. You're a sinner. You're evil.
Yeah. You're wretched. Thankfully,
you're wretched. Exactly. But thankfully Jesus's blood is going to wash all that away and we're going to sing about it. And so, yeah, the worship leader and I, his name's Troy, we're like, man, but there's not really that many to.
Yeah, what are you left with?
Yeah. And to treat him fairly, you know, he did say, look, some of these songs, he maybe cleaned them up a little bit, but they're just part of the tradition. The complexity of the hymn catalog is going to stay, some of it.
Yeah.
But other songs just had to go totally. So yeah. Anyway.
Well, and I was listening to a podcast with John Shelby Spong, and even this conversation about the, like, we're so awful, God, but we keep telling you, God, that you're great and we suck. But I love he called it slave talk. It's like, God, mm-hmm. You're everything, but I'm nothing. You're everything, I'm nothing. And even him packaging that, I was like, oh my word, that's really what's going on. But I guess you don't see it until you start to look at these beliefs a little bit more, like, and ask questions about, like, hold on a second, like, what is this really doing to humanity, to our psyche, to our spirit? What's it creating in us? And I really appreciate your work that you did in the book.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks.
So another idea, and it's in your book as well, that I wanted to have you talk about is this idea of the loyal soldier. Mm-hmm. So maybe for our audience that is not familiar with that, can you just explain to us what that is and your connection with that and why that's been such an important piece in your journey?
Yeah, sure. One of the things that started happening to me is that I started to disbelieve certain things. I don't know how else to say it, but disbelieve basic tenets of evangelical Christianity, like original sin, for example, or atonement theology. But the problem is that it's not as simple as just, well, I don't believe those things anymore, and I'm going to believe something different. Because you have this entire unconscious world that's operative in your psyche, in your heart even, but let's just use psyche, that is also has a certain agenda in mind. So for me, when I started to walk away a bit from traditional Christianity, I had all these voices going off like alarm bells, like, But they were saying things like, you're going to ruin your life. Now, these are mostly unconscious, as I'm describing. You're going to ruin your life. You're not going to be able to pay the bills. You're not going to be accepted by your family. Sometimes even you're not going to be accepted by God. Well, I came to discover that this is what psychologists call loyal soldier voices. Not that they have the same message, but they're voices that kept us safe, mostly in childhood. And by safe, I mean a part of the tribe,
okay,
part of the group of belonging. And they did a really good job. So I grew up in fundamentalist Christianity. So for me to be safe and accepted, I needed to believe the right things. I needed to believe in Jesus. I needed to accept Jesus. Otherwise, not only would I not be accepted in the community, but God wouldn't accept me eternally. So these, of course, what else are you going to do as a child except believe these things?
Yeah.
So to walk away from them is not intellectual. There's an intellectual component to it, but it's much more psycho-spiritual. And once you begin to hear these voices, and for me, I talk about this in the book a little bit, some of the voices were, how do I stay safe in this room, please enough people? And as a pastor, a lot of pastors are people pleasers, and that's really why they're making decisions. It has very little to do with the truth or what they believe. They might not even know what they believe, but it's a matter of, how do I stay safe in this room and please enough people in this room so that I can keep my job and keep everybody happy enough? That's the work of the loyal soldier. And then
we prepare a sermon about integrity.
Exactly. No, I know. I've done this. Yeah, you know, right. I've given whole sermons on authenticity and you know, turned my back on it on Monday. So, that's that. And I think that's just part of being, you know, a human. We're all hypocrites. We all have those tendencies. But so anyway, this image became very important to me, because if I was going to go out beyond the edge of the village, or if I was going to step into the unknown, I was going to have to thank these loyal soldier voices for keeping me safe. Thank you. But I want to cross into a country I haven't been before. And the operating strategies of the loyal soldier, I don't need anymore. I don't want to listen to anymore. They don't totally go away. It's not like you can just chuck them out the window, but,
yeah.
I had to say, no, even if I displease people, I'm going to take this step. Even if I don't know what I'm going to do, even if my life is going to fall apart, I want to find the courage, and courage comes from the heart in Latin, maybe. I want to find the heart to live a life that isn't just ruled by these unconscious and internal voices that I call in the book, the loyal soldier. And I find when I talk to people about this, you know, they have, maybe they wouldn't use loyal soldier, but they have voices like that try to keep them small. And that's really the job. Like, how can you stay small? And, another one I just came across recently, by the way, in a book, maybe you've heard of this book, Women Who Run with the Wolves, but she has another word for it, I think. And that is, and a more feminine word, and that is the voice of the too good mother.
Okay.
So maybe the feminine, doesn't connect with loyal soldier, because it's kind of, that can be a masculine kind of image, but yeah. The voice of the too good mother, meaning this motherly voice that no, a mother does this and she should be like this and a woman should do this. And those should statements are little clues that, these are, some of our unconscious patterns that have tried to keep us safe. But if we're going to grow up, we have to dismiss them in a way, or thank them and move on.
Yeah. So I noticed in your book, I mean, because I know a little bit more about your history, but maybe for our audience, just to know a little bit more of what were you were walking away from as far as just your upbringing, your family, because you'd say you grew up in this fundamentalism, but I think maybe a little bit more specifics might be helpful in kind of understanding your story.
Yeah, sure. Well, my dad worked for Jerry Falwell in the 80s. And so this was Christian, right-wing Christian fundamentalism. It was the age of what they call the moral majority. My dad helped create that thing. Or another word for it would be the religious right. And okay. This was a mixing of political power, Republican political power, and Christianity. They were saying something like, if you want to be a good Christian, you have to vote Republican, and we're going to vote our values into American democracy.
Wow.
And we're going to take over America and keep it from the liberal, slippery slope, progressive, whatever, fill in the blank, from tree huggers and you know, all these.
Oh, the save the earth people. Gosh.
Yeah. And also the main moral issues at the time were around abortion and things like this. And, but I was a kid at the time. So, but that was the world I grew up in. And then my dad eventually left that and became a pastor. And in his own way, kind of went on a radical journey away from a super politicized Christianity to a more like, no, it's about the local congregation and that was kind of his path. But that's still very much evangelical Christianity. And, so what I'm saying I have been leaving is not just Christian fundamentalism, but also it's kind of contemporary evangelical iteration, which is big mega church. Still rooted in the same kind of theology, which is atonement theology. There's a saved camp and a non-saved camp, and Jesus is going to fix us. That was what I slowly started to walk away from. And with that comes a certain attachment to the Bible. So what I call in the book, Bible worship. I was a part of a church called Mars Hill Bible Church. And this was like, everything we do, we know for sure stands on the authority of the Bible. Well, once you start poking around and what do you mean by that, then the ground is actually very shaky. And I didn't want to root my theology or spiritual practice on that same foundation anymore.
Okay, so speaking of the Bible, for our audience, Kent basically wrote the Bible, just so you know. So he did a whole commentary for an NIV. It's called the First Century Study Bible? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Kent has done a lot of work with just understanding the Jewish context of a lot of this writing. And so one of my questions for you is, I would love for you to maybe talk a little bit about what are some specific examples that you've seen that many Christians, you know, 2,000 years removed, well, or even more than that, these writings, that we read it and we don't really know what's going on, or it's been preached a way that's not really what it's about. Just give us a couple examples of kind of getting into that world of context and the Jewishness of Jesus. I know there's probably a billion things, right?
Yeah, there are a billion things. I'll give you the first thing that came into my head. Moses comes down the mountain, Sinai, and he sees the people worshiping a golden calf. And he has in his arms the Ten Commandments, and on them it says, make no graven image. And he smashes them, right? He smashes these tablets, and he's angry, which is funny already. That brings like, wait a minute, they don't know what's on the tablets.
Yeah.
So that's one argument. You could almost defend them. Like, what do you mean? They don't have this. Don't worship a graven image, or make no graven image. So, but anyway, so that's just like a little side note. And he smashes them. But just before Aaron makes the calf, or just after, so he makes the calf, and this is what it says in Hebrew. It says, this is your God. And the word in Hebrew is Elohim.
Okay.
And then he says, tomorrow we shall have a festival to Yahweh. So that's what the Hebrew says. So here is your Elohim, and tomorrow we'll have a festival to Yahweh. Now, those are two different names for God, Elohim and Yahweh, and both of them are in the creation account. So you have Elohim is in the opening chapter, and then Yahweh is in the second chapter of Genesis. What does that tell you? It tells you they're not worshiping what we would call an idol. They're not.
Okay.
They're worshiping Elohim. They're worshiping Yahweh. They're just doing it through this culturally relevant delivery system of the golden calf. Now, you might say why, and now we could get into cultural background stuff. So the reason why I'm saying that is because if you hear preachers talk, they'll say, oh, how, what idiots. Moses comes down and they're worshiping the golden calf, bowing down to it. No.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that.
They're
yeah.
worshiping Elohim. They're worshiping Yahweh. Now, the form is a golden calf, but Aaron is the priest. He is inviting this ceremony to the God of the Hebrews. Now, why do most people not know that? Well, that's just because they haven't looked. Either they don't know Hebrew, which is okay, or they've been, the story has been spun in a certain way, which, yeah. by the way, actually, as I'm thinking about it, has a lot of cultural relevance because we like to worship God in our culturally appropriate ways. Like we have television screens and we have worship songs and we think, what's wrong with that? Well, that's exactly what the Israelites were doing with the golden calf. What's wrong with the golden calf? Absolutely nothing. That's what we know. Because we make objects and we invite the deity to dwell in that object in some special way. And that's what we're used to. So it's really no different.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Like, so I don't know. That's like, what is that? That's nothing super special. That's just beginning to pay attention to language, to culture. And as soon as you do that, the Bible becomes less black and white. It becomes nuanced. It becomes subtle. You don't get to throw whole groups under the bus like, oh, stupid Israelites don't know what they're doing. Wait a minute. What was going on for them? Or anyway, the Bible becomes, at least in my view, much more rich and nuanced. So that's like one small example.
Dude, give us another one, man. I love this stuff.
let's see another one. Yeah, let me think of something from the Gospels. Here's a cultural background one. Jesus is asked, should we pay taxes to Caesar or not? And actually, the word in Greek means, should we pay the tribute tax to Caesar or not? This is something that Caesar demanded, that everyone pay a yearly tax. And they used a particular coin for that tax, the tribute coin. And what we know from archaeology and from, also just from Roman records, whatever, is that the coins that they use for tribute tax had Caesar's image on it.
Okay.
And so this is in Jesus' time, this is Caesar Tiberius. And on the coin, it said Son of God. It's a very intriguing title, right? So they say, Jesus, should we pay taxes? Which is a question of revolt and autonomy.
Okay.
In other words, should we play the Roman game? That's what we're asking him. That's what they're asking him. And that was a big debate in Jesus's day because the zealots were like, no, we shouldn't pay our taxes. We should be an autonomous theocracy. You know, talk about, I don't mean this in any derogatory sense, but the Puritans that started America wanted a theocracy. The Taliban wants a theocracy. You know, this is like government and God, you know, and that was the zealots. They said, no, we don't want Roman rule. We want to be ruled by God and by our own laws. So in any case, that's what's behind the question. And if Jesus says, don't pay your taxes, then he's a zealot. All right. But if he says, pay your taxes, he disappoints all the people. You know, they're like,
yeah.
Come on, man. We don't want to be under Roman rule. So he says, show me a coin. Whose image is on it? Well, Caesar's. And then he says, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, which is a kind of like a way of skirting around the issue. Because
yeah, I know. I'm like, what does that mean?
It's not, it doesn't belong to us. So give it back to him. But then Jesus follows that by saying, but give to God's what is God's. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know exactly what Jesus means by that, but Caesar's on the coin, it says, Son of God. And part of the paying tribute was also this Caesar worship at the time. So perhaps what Jesus is saying is, look, the coin belongs to Caesar. Who cares? Give it back to him, but give to God's what is God's. Maybe he's saying, but don't worship Caesar. Maybe he's saying that. Don't worship Caesar, you know? Because Caesar does not deserve the coin he can have, but he doesn't deserve to be worshipped. So that, I think, would be a cultural background. It's an interpretive guess on my part, but all those nuances were not lost on the original audience. They knew what was on the coin. They knew what Caesar was claiming to be divine, the son of God. And so, I mean, it just, I guess it just has political and religious overtones that are all mixed together. And so just knowing a little bit, makes Jesus way more provocative, interesting, instead of just like, hey, we should like, you know, you should pay your taxes, just like Jesus said. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's. It's not that simple. It's more complicated.
Yeah. And this is why I love listening to you speak. I love your writing, because I don't know. It just like, it makes the Bible come into color instead of being this kind of like, all right, well, these sacred texts. And I mean, I'm a Christian, so I'm supposed to just totally love and be, you know, it's like I've reached a point in my journey where, kind of like you said, like it just no longer worked to understand it in this way that it felt everything was so literal and black and white. And so to bring it into color is just, I feel like I have so many friends that are in that place of needing to hear things like this. So, yeah, it's awesome.
And the Bible, see, what's funny is that in some ways I appreciate the Bible more, even though I don't believe that it's inerrant.
Yeah.
Meaning without error, which is a made up thing in 1913, if you really want to know.
That is crazy.
It like is crazy.
100 years ago. Wow.
100 years ago. Yeah. Protestants decided we're going to claim that the Bible's without error in its historical blah, blah, blah. And they have this list of things. But Jesus never had the New Testament. He never believed in the inerrancy of Scripture. He had a high view of Scripture, we could say. He seemed to love it. But it was literature. It was a work of history and mythology and poetry, and it's the stories of our ancestors, and he didn't need to believe certain things about it. And Paul was just fine without a New Testament. Most of the early Christianity did not have a New Testament. You know, they just had stories that they passed around. So how we ended up worshiping the Bible is a bit of a puzzle to me, because our the founders of Christianity, if you want to put it that way, didn't worship the Bible. They worship the God to which the Bible seems to point, to tell stories about. And that's kind of what I would argue is a healthier way of moving forward. All right, we have these stories. We have these texts that many consider sacred. What are they talking about? How are they talking about it? How might they work on us? But we don't need to bow down before the words and, you know, claim ridiculous things like in Joshua, it says the sun stood still, and that's a literal thing. So for a while, you know, the earth just stopped spinning. No, that's absurd. We don't need to do that. We don't need to make those claims.
I mean, okay. So with you talking about like this about the Bible, I mean, you probably have people that are, I love your, Heresy Hunt or Heresy Watch, that little section.
Heresy Hunters.
Yeah. That little section in the book was great. But is there anything that you found to be helpful? Cause I guess for me, when I think about conversations I get to have about the Bible, so saying worship the Bible, most Christians be like, no way, I don't do that. No way. That's not me. But I don't know. It actually is. So, I mean, what have you found to be helpful in conversation? Or is it just kind of like, well, they'll see it when they see it, or maybe they'll never see it and has to be the way it is. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I mean, sometimes I just think about it as it's a good starting place. And this is kind of like, maybe there's some irony in what I'm saying. I'm actually grateful for my fundamentalist upbringing, because I know the Bible better than most people. And it's not because I'm smart. It's because I grew up as a fundamentalist Christian, and we memorized the Bible. We talked about it. We knew the stories. I mean, not that long ago, I was with a friend of mine, a Jewish friend of mine, and he was quoting, he was talking about a story, the story of Jacob. And I informed him, this is a Jewish person who had a bar mitzvah. I informed him of some very basic facts of the story of Jacob. And he's like, I don't even know what you're talking about. It's in your Torah. So how did I know that? I knew that only because I was really brought up with these stories. And so in a way, I'm grateful for that. And I think the stories themselves really do work on it. There's a reason why they've lasted for 3,000 years. They're rich. They're archetypal. They're symbolic. They have depth. They have nuance. There's not a single interpretation, and to begin to have a conversation with them is to begin to have a richer spiritual life. So I almost trust that the stories will dismantle our own views of the Bible itself. They really will.
Yeah. Okay.
And I don't know. I part of it is just growing up. Maybe you have to start with, you don't have to, but suppose you start with a very rigid, God said it, I believe it, all the stories are true. Well, if you hang out there for a while, you'll start to say, wait a minute. It says in three of the Gospels that Jesus gave them bread and then wine in the Last Supper, but one of them it says he gave them wine first and then bread. Now, both of those things can't be true. They can't be true.
Yeah. But
that is, otherwise, it's just a massive cut. So you have to say, wait a minute, maybe the Bible's not playing the same game that I'm imposing on the Bible.
Okay.
And once you get there, then the door's open. And I think you're ready to let the Bible just be a little messy. And most people will get there, even the ones who take it seriously. Now, some people are just going to plug their ears. La, 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 la. I'm not listening to that. But I'm not too worried about that. You know, just, I don't know, just let it be, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you're, I don't have the book in my hand right now, but the subline is leaving church, finding God, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I guess just going back to your journey a little bit. So when did you actually take this step to move yourself outside of formal like Christian pastorhood? Oh, that was a gross way to say it, but anyways. when did you do that? And I mean, yeah, what are you doing now?
Okay, yeah, let me say a couple things.
Okay.
That's a subtitle that I didn't come up with. Leaving Church, Finding God. I would not have subtitled the book that way, but that's marketing.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, first of all, who would claim like what I left church and found God. I mean, I wouldn't take a subtitle like that seriously, but anyway, it wasn't my call in the end, but I get the nuance of it. If I wanted to go further on the spiritual life, I was going to have to leave the confines of being a church pastor. So,
okay.
That's what, and when did that start? Well, subtly it started 5 or 6 years ago. It started more directly 2 years ago when I all of a sudden said, I'm not doing this anymore. And I made the announcement and set out on what I was calling the unknown. And I meant that kind of existentially and also, vocationally. And what have I been doing since? I got involved in a program through a place called Animus. So, this is a place in Colorado. And this was psycho-spiritual work out in nature. It's where I learned about the loyal soldier. So I tried to take my own work more seriously at this point in my life. Like, no, I need to look at some things. I need a therapist. I need a spiritual director. I want to go through some programs. I want to take a more careful look. So I did that. I continued to lead Israel trips. That's essentially how I paid the bills. I got a few part-time jobs. I started a community garden with a friend. I worked at a restaurant for a while.
Wow.
And I got this book deal and, I have a small publisher. So really every book sale matters. And just recently in the last couple of weeks, I agreed to do some teaching, half the Sundays of the year at a local non-church. That's what I would call it. It's a place called C3. It's out here in Michigan. And they call themselves an inclusive spiritual community. So West Michigan's inclusive spiritual community. They used to be a church in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. And then they dropped their doctrines. They took the cross down. They sold their building. They rent a community center. And it attracts a lot of Christians, I think, former Christians, some non-religious people, spiritual people, some Buddhists, and a few Jews. And they,
all right,
they
I love it.
I know. It was the kind of place that if I could start, I would. But it turned out someone else had already started, and they were looking for a new leader. So strangely, I'm back in the world of giving Sunday talks. But it's in a values-based community, not a doctrinal, creedal kind of place. So it's kind of a new experiment, and I'm excited about it. I'm, it means I'm going to stay in the conversation of spirituality and religion, and I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Oh, that's great, man. Well, I wanted to get into, and this might, depending how long we go on, this might need to be our last question. But in a previous conversation, we talked about this idea, concept of shadow work and soul work. Mm-hmm. I actually talked to my wife about it last night, and she was like, can you have Kent explain those? Because she, for her, she said, I've heard three different definitions of what that means. So tell Kent he needs to do that for you. So, yeah, share with us about what that is, what that means. And
yeah, okay. Shadow work and soul work. Well, I mean, we'd have to, I'll speak in some generalities, and you can, you know, poke around in them if you want. Soul work. What do I mean by soul work? Soul is one's ultimate place in the world. That's kind of the way I would define it. Like your essence, who you are beneath your titles, even your name, your family background, the sort of seed of your existence. I think what Thomas Merton would call your true self is soul work. And it's a slightly different path than the spiritual path, meaning connection with God, which is about transcendence. So you transcend your personality or your ego, and you have a connection with the whole, with God, with oneness, with Christ. But the soul path is more of a descent. And that's how it is in literature, in mythology, where you descend, you'd sink beneath who you think you are in the world, which feels much like a dark night, a dark journey, only to discover bits and pieces of your true self, which is kind of more like an image, not a vocation. Actually, that's Carl Jung. Jung says that the soul is an image, which makes it even harder to kind of get at. But I became interested in this because when you are a big mega church pastor and you have a title and you're a scholar and you have a, you can stand up there and give sermons
and
you have
the Bible.
A personality in the world that makes sense. Yeah, exactly. You start to get curious about what's beneath all that. Is there anything beneath all that? And that's the soul journey. And with that comes shadow work. And shadow is, as defined again by Jung, shadow is what you don't yet know about yourself. Mm. That's the simplest way of putting it. If you knew about it, it wouldn't be in the shadow. And your everyday personality, your ego, doesn't want to go near the shadow. All right. Because it's scary in there. And now the amazing thing about shadow work is that it contains both darkness, meaning unsavory things about yourself that you don't want to look at, and also gifts. Okay. And another way of saying that is like this kind of wound gift, dual-sided coin. You start going near your wounds, you're actually getting kind of close to your gifts. Well, it's similar with shadow work. Like, you start going toward unsavory things, you also are starting to move toward golden things. Things that are your really profound gifts. Now, why is this important? Well, because if you want to get to know yourself, even if you want to go on the soul path, you're going to have to walk toward your shadowy material. Now, the way the shadow works, according to psychotherapists and people who are smarter than me, is that the way to begin to detect it is when you find yourself insisting that there's no way you're like so-and-so.
Okay.
So you project these negative or positive qualities onto other people, which is largely what's happening in our politics. It's a bunch of people who don't want to go anywhere near their shadows. So they project it out onto the other, that group, that person. And it's on the right and the left. Like sometimes I hear Donald Trump and it makes me very angry. Part of that is that there are things that he's doing and saying that are also, I don't want to admit, I am sometimes like that. Mm. Otherwise, the visceral anger doesn't make sense. I don't know him. You know, I don't know him. I've never met the guy.
Yeah.
And same can happen also with gold and stuff, with shadows. So if there's an artist, like a friend of mine's a photographer, and he would say things like, there's no way my photographs could be as good as so-and-so. There's no way, which means part of absorbing back his shadow or owning it is saying, actually, no, the way I see the world, I could take photos. I could take photos that are better than that. And I don't mean in a competitive sense,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Instead of letting someone else carry that gift, you begin to own it. Same with negative stuff. Instead of, if I go around saying, there's no way I'm a racist, no way on earth, the one thing I know about myself is that there's not a racist bone in my body. You better believe there's a racist bone in my body.
Yeah.
Because that's how shadow work works. So unless I'm willing to say, actually, I have to admit, the other day when I was going out and I was leaving a parking lot and it was at night and I saw a black guy walking in the parking lot, I locked my doors. Mm-hmm. Had it been a white, blonde sorority girl, maybe I wouldn't have done the same.
Yeah.
That's me getting closer to some of my own racism. Even though I'm like liberal, you know,
yeah, all progressive. Yeah,
exactly. BS. So, and that's part of soul path. So if you want to go on the soul path, it means you're going to have to walk toward your unsavory bits.
Yeah. Okay.
And,
so
and you need some help. Yeah.
Yeah. For some help there. I mean, give me a couple books. I mean, for me personally, I was with the spiritual director for the past year and oh my word, did that. Just that like began the breaking of me of so much that was going on inside that was just like, I just wasn't aware of it. So I can say that as a recommendation, but I mean, give us a couple books that you feel like might be helpful in this.
Well, I mean, Jung, if you want to just read, go straight to the source, you can read Carl Jung. He's got a book called, this is more of a compilation called The Undiscovered Self. I think he talks a bit about the shadow in there. So I got interested through the work of Bill Plotkin. Person who started this Animus Valley Institute that I went to. So Bill Plotkin, he has a more palatable, so in a book called Wild Mind, he talks about the shadow. And it's kind of like, it's easier than reading Jung. That's one source. But actually a lot of different people are, psychology, even pop psychology is getting a little bit closer to people doing their shadow work. Now, most of the time, by the way, just a bit of a caveat, it's difficult.
Yeah.
So having a spiritual director, having a therapist, having a trusted partner that knows what they're talking about is a much safer way of trying to get near this. There's a really famous book by the poet Robert Bly called The Little Book on the Human Shadow.
Okay.
I highly recommend it. So he's got some really interesting things to say about it. But what I would say, just in the most general sense, people on the spiritual path should start to get curious about this, because when you have people who are unwilling to look at the shadow, then you have the insanity of our political culture. So if we're going to grow up culturally, we're going to have to do our individual work. There are going to have to be groups, because there's also the collective shadow. You know, liberals and conservatives are going to have to start to do their shadow work. And otherwise, there's not going to be healing, reconciliation, empathy, growth. It's just going to resort to more polarization and violence.
Yeah. Oh man, that's so good. Well, one of my buddies, Michael, shout out Michael, if you listen to this. I mean, we have like 8 people that listen to it, but maybe he's one of them. My buddy Michael, he read your book recently too. And one of the things he pointed out that I was like, oh, that's so good, is you talk about how the people that are on like the heresy hunt and the heresy watch, and your response is like, no, I am like at the very bottom of the pit of pits, the darkness, like I'm all the way down that thing. So like, whatever, it's fine. And so Michael, he was really relating to that. And I feel like I love your honesty, your vulnerability, just to say like, yeah, no, that's where I was in that season. Maybe still in that season in some ways, right? But that we've got to get back to that place of being able to just admit, say where we are, kind of take off the, especially in church, like take off the church face, the smiley, happy, clappy thing. Like, man, everybody sees through it. Well, not everybody, but most people see through it these days. And so it's really refreshing to hear the way you talk about this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, what I said in the, is that
my messed up quote. Yeah, fix it.
No, it's fine. No, you got the gist of it. I was trying to say two things. One, if anyone is trying to hunt for heresies, go ahead. I'm a heretic. I have no problem with that.
Yeah.
And actually, heresy just means to hold an opinion. I'm just trying to find an opinion, you know? And the other is the slippery slope metaphor. Now, that meant a lot more to me because in fundamentalism, I grew up and they were always threatening the slippery slope. But I just was saying, I'm at the bottom. I slid all the way down the hill. So you can't say you're on the slippery slope. I went down. So, and here I am at the bottom. And there are a lot of other people down here with me.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if people are hunting around in my stuff, trying to call me a heretic, it really doesn't bother me. I mean, it might hurt a little bit. But again, I also see some of that stuff as, to bring it back to the shadow, when people say that person is the problem and they scapegoat and they try to send them out of the village, it's probably because they're mirroring back to them something they don't want to look at. So if they say that guy is a doubter, and the one thing I know about myself is I'm not a doubter, then you can be pretty sure somewhere down there, they have their own doubts and they can't get close to him yet. They cannot get close. I hope they do, but they can't get close to him yet. So they need to pin it on people like me or whoever, whatever kind of, whoever the popular figure is to pin it on them and send them out of the building. But that's only going to work for so long. Then it's not going to work.
Okay. Going to go a total different direction. And this might be whatever. I'll just go with it. Okay. So for somebody like you, who's, you know, gone on this journey and this, you've studied, looked into so much scholarly work, historical, all the stuff specifically about Jesus. I mean, what is so compelling about Jesus still for you that makes you say, I still want to be in the game. I still want to reframe conversations and talk about this.
Oh man. Well, I'm not trying to stay in the Christian game necessarily. Yeah. What I found at the very bottom of the Christian story is something that I think is true. So why do I want to stay in the conversation? I want to stay with whatever's true. And what's at the bottom that's true for me, is that the big story of death and resurrection, or Jesus uses another metaphor, rebirth, this is what we would call transformation. And that's another word for it. So I think there's something profoundly true about the way people change. And it's through the process of death and resurrection. It's through dying to some old way of life and some new way of life being born. And Christianity just happens to not be the only religious or spiritual voice that's echoing similar themes. I mean, actually, death and resurrection comes straight from Greek mythology. That's what they were saying about part of being a human being is and growing up into an adult and into an elder requires the kind of death of something. The death of, in contemporary language, we would say our egoic adolescent selves or something like that. And to be transformed by a mystery, that would be what I would call God, and be a life-giving, generative presence in the world that brings about goodness and light. And but anyway, so what am I describing? I'm describing the big pattern. Mm-hmm. And the same exists in the Exodus narrative, where you have the world of slavery, and you pass through the desert into the promised land. I'm saying that symbol works profoundly. And now what do I want to stay in the game of? Any story that is about soul discovery, transformation, the big journey, I don't care if it's from Greek mythology, if it's Christianity, if it's, I'm not that familiar with you know, all world religions or something like that.
Yeah.
But whatever stories are true on the level of the soul, the heart, transformation, that's the game, so to speak, that I want to be in. And I happen to trust that Christianity is saying something profoundly true, more true than I'm even able to recognize. It just is not, doesn't necessarily conform to the creedal structures that we've tried to organize around it. So
yeah,
anyway.
Right on, man. Well, yeah, let's wrap up our time, dude. It's been so good to have you on here. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
Where can our listeners find out more about you and your work? And specifically, I mean, you lead those retreats and Israel trips. So, I mean, tell us a little bit more about those.
Yeah, they can. So I have a website, kendobson.com. That's pretty much the go-to place if you want to see what I'm up to. You can get the book there. You can get it through Amazon. Actually, it's just a link to Amazon anyway. Yeah, and I lead retreats. I like to lead retreats out in the wild world, the natural world. And they tend to be along the lines of soul discovery, place, people who are in positions in life where they're kind of unsure about what's next. I want to have those conversations. And I do occasionally lead trips to Israel. I've got one coming up in December.
And right on.
I did a bunch this year. I won't do as many next year. I kind of have seasons where I'm energized for it. And that's a pilgrimage. And it's not a highly political trip, though we can't avoid politics. And it's not a super Bible trip. It's sort of just a mixture of a lot of things.
Cool.
It's a pilgrimage. It's an adventure. It's a conversation, with a group of people. So it's fun.
Ah, right on, man. Yeah. Well, good stuff, dude. Thanks again for being on the show with us.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me. Thanks. Good questions. So.
All right, man. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Sounds good.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Voices Podcast. If you want to get the links for anything we talked about today, they will be in the show notes on patreon.com/voicespodcast. If you go there, you can scroll down to the episode and you will see all the links right there.
And if you're interested in becoming a supporter of the show, we are on Patreon. So you can go to our Patreon website and you'll see different levels of supporting the show. That helps us to get different guests on the show, put more time and resources to this. And one of the things we want to do is be a resource to you on your spiritual journey. That was the whole vision behind this in the first place. So one of those ways we do that is at different levels, there are different resources that we'll make available to you as you are working through reimagining faith.
We also want you to be able to join the conversation with us. So make sure you leave us a comment on Facebook or tweet at us on Twitter. We are Voices Podcast on Facebook and at Voices Pod on Twitter. Let us know what you thought, agreed with, disagreed with, and what you want to hear more about.
All right. Thanks for listening.